You're tuned to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio. Democracy Now! Is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Jenny Tuno, proudly supporting community radio and Democracy Now! On KZFR.
Democracy Now!
I'm so sorry. Is there anything I can do for you right now?
Can you call the philosophy department office and tell them I've been requested?
Fill up philosophy department?
Yes. Call the philosophy department office.
Riot police arrest the chair of the philosophy department at Emory University and over two dozen others on campus using tear gas and tasers as a wave of student protests against Israel's war in Gaza continues to spread from coast to coast. More than 500 people have been arrested. We'll go to Atlanta to hear from a Palestinian-American grad student organizer and two arrested professors. Then the Supreme Court hears oral arguments on Idaho's abortion ban and emergency health care.
The doctors are facing mandatory minimum, 2 years in prison, loss of their license, criminal prosecution. The doctors can't provide the care because until they can conclude that a prosecutor looking over their shoulder won't second guess that maybe it wasn't really necessary to prevent death.
We'll speak with the legal director of Pregnancy Justice and take a look at how minority rule is reinforced by the current Supreme Court.
We have a conservative supermajority that was appointed by Republican presidents who lost the popular vote and confirmed by Republican senators representing a minority of Americans.
We'll speak with Ari Berman, author of the new book, Minority Rule, the Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The University of Southern California has canceled its main commencement ceremony, less than 2 weeks after it canceled a speech by the valedictorian Asnath Basam, setting off a firestorm. Police arrested over 90 peaceful protesters at USC Wednesday. Nationwide, over 500 arrests have been made on college campuses, including faculty. As student-led protests have swept the country. Just over the past day, new Gaza solidarity encampments and protests formed at Northwestern, Cornell, George Washington University, CUNY, and UCLA, among others. Students are calling for their schools to divest from Israel and stop censoring Palestinian and pro-Palestinian voices and drop charges against arrested staff and students. At Emory in Atlanta, a brutal police crackdown led to at least 28 arrests. Among those arrested was economics professor Caroline Folan, who was knocked to the ground by a police officer while another held her down and bound her hands with zip ties. We'll go to Atlanta after headlines for the latest at Emory. We'll speak with two arrested professors and a grad student. Meanwhile, students at Columbia University, the epicenter of the student encampment movement, filed a civil rights complaint Thursday following arrests by the NYPD and threats to deploy the National Guard. Despite the violent crackdown, students vowed to continue their protests. This is Vincent Doerr of UCLA.
I don't think that our concerns about our personal safety are at the forefront of our minds right now. I think at the forefront of our minds is the violence that Palestinians are suffering at the hands of the Israeli state every day these last 6 months and last, again, almost 80 years.
In Gaza, the city of Rafah remains under nonstop Israeli attacks as Israel prepares to move ahead with its ground invasion. 8-year-old Abdelkarim Al-Kurd described the moment his home was attacked Thursday night.
At night, we were sleeping quietly, my brother and I, in a bedroom. My mother and my grandfather were awake, so when they shelled, the rubble was above our heads and the glass was shattered and the house was smashed. Here, if you want, go and look. The whole house was destroyed. Nothing is left in it.
In other news from the region, a Hamas official said the group would disarm if an independent Palestinian state is established and refugees are allowed to return. The New York Court of Appeals overturned the 2020 rape conviction of Harvey Weinstein Thursday and called for a new trial in a stunning development in his historic case. The disgraced Hollywood mogul was sentenced to 23 years in prison after his 2020 conviction. But the appeals court cited the improper use of what's known as prior bad acts witnesses. In this case, that refers to survivors of Weinstein that testified about their assaults, even though they were not part of the case being tried. Tarana Burke, founder of the Me Too movement, addressed the news yesterday.
We are devastated for the survivors who are connected to this case and the survivors who had found some solace and catharsis in the original verdict around Harvey Weinstein. We also need to understand that the legal system has never served survivors in this country. Carceral solutions won't save us.
Harvey Weinstein's 16-year sentence for sexual crimes committed in California is not affected by Thursday's ruling, though Weinstein's expected to appeal that conviction next. At least 87 survivors have accused Weinstein of rape or sexual misconduct. The U.S. Supreme Court appeared skeptical of Donald Trump's claim of absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for his attempts to overturn his 2020 election loss. This is liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor questioning Trump's lawyers.
We would be creating a situation in which we would be saying, this is what you're asking us to say, which is that a president is entitled not to make a mistake, but more than that, a president is entitled for total personal gain to use the trappings of his office. That's what you're trying to get us to hold, without facing criminal liability.
Conservative justice questioned whether the charges against Trump constituted private acts or official acts, which could potentially be shielded from prosecution. But a resolution to the pivotal case could be further delayed, possibly beyond November's election, as the Supreme Court weighs sending the case back to lower courts for further deliberation. This comes as Trump's criminal hush money trial continues in New York. On Thursday, former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker told the court he made deals with Michael Cohen and Trump to kill embarrassing stories that would damage his presidential campaign, including Trump's alleged affair with Playboy model Karen McDougal. Burkina Faso's U.S.-trained military forces summarily executed at least 223 civilians, including dozens of children, across several villages in the northern Yatenga province in late February. That's according to a new report by Human Rights Watch, which says the extrajudicial mass killings are part of a widespread military campaign to exterminate residents accused of collaborating with Islamic militants. Human Rights Executive Director Tarana Hassan said in a statement, quote, "The repeated failure of the Burkinabe authorities to prevent and investigate such atrocities underlines why international assistance is critical to support a credible investigation into possible crimes against humanity." Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry has resigned, paving the way for an unelected transitional council to temporarily govern Haiti as the nation faces a worsening humanitarian and security crisis. On the streets of Haiti, locals remain skeptical.
We want to know if this council can fight the gangs, if they can win back security, because personally, I want to be able to go back to Port-au-Prince. If they can't fight the gangs, then I'm going to face them. I'm going to become their enemy. They got two missions, elections and security, but security comes first.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Thursday he wants the swift deployment of a multinational security mission as the transitional government is installed. In Brazil, thousands of indigenous leaders have been rallying in Brasilia this week, calling on the government to recognize their ancestral lands and enforce stronger protections against illegal mining and other forms of exploitation. Protesters also denounced plans to build a railway that would transport grains across Brazil's farming states to ports in the Amazon rainforest. A group of indigenous leaders met with the Brazilian president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, while others gathered outside government buildings.
In the past, we died by the knife, the bullet, and today we die by the pen, by making laws, by the law, and taking away our rights. This is a huge genocide that can happen within our nation, within the people, because our indigenous land is life. For us, it is forest and life.
A sweltering heat wave across South and Southeast Asia has four schools in India, the Philippines, and Bangladesh to suspend classes this week. Record temperatures have also disrupted agriculture across the region. The World Meteorological Organization warned Asia remains, quote, the world's most disaster-hit region from weather, climate, and water-related hazards. In Thailand, at least 30 people have been reported dead due to heat strokes so far this year. The Environmental Protection Agency finalized new rules Thursday requiring coal-fired power plants to either cut or capture 90% of their carbon dioxide emissions by 2032 or shut down. Power plants are the second largest source of greenhouse gas emissions after transportation. But climate groups criticized the regulations' reliance on unproven technologies rather than reducing fossil fuel usage. The group Food and Water Watch said, quote, pretending that carbon capture can dramatically reduce climate pollution is nothing but a dangerous fantasy, they said. And the Federal Communications Commission voted to restore net neutrality Thursday in a major win for digital and consumer rights. The five-member commission voted 3-2 to fully reinstate rules established under President Obama and repealed by President Trump that regulated broadband like other utilities and barred internet providers from blocking or degrading certain websites or charging for faster connection. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A wave of student protest against Israel's war in Gaza continues to spread from coast to coast across U.S. campuses. From California to Connecticut, students have set up Gaza solidarity encampments to call for an end to the Israeli assault and for university divestment from Israel and the U.S. arms industry. University administrators have responded by calling in law enforcement, forcibly removing encampments, arresting students and faculty, and suspending students. More than 500 arrests have been made on campuses nationwide in just over a week. One of the most violent police crackdowns took place at Emory University in Atlanta Thursday. Local and state police swept onto the campus just hours after students set up tents on the quad to protest Israel's war in Gaza, as well as the planned Atlanta Police Training Center known as Cop City. Police were accused of using tear gas, rubber bullets, and stun guns to break up the encampment as they wrestled people to the ground. One video shows multiple officers restraining a protester as they apply and hold a taser to his leg as students around him yelled for them to stop. In an email addressing the situation shortly afterwards, the president of Emory University wrote several dozen individuals, quote, largely not affiliated with the university entered the campus for the protest, disrupting the Emory community amidst final exams. The university later said 20 of the 28 people arrested had ties to the school. Among those arrested were a number of faculty members, including the chair of the philosophy department at Emory University, Noelle McCaffey. A bystander filmed her being led away in handcuffs.
I'm so sorry. Is there anything I can do for you right now?
Yes, can you call the philosophy department office and tell them I've been arrested?
Philosophy department?
Yes, call the philosophy department office.
Well, Democracy Now! Spoke to Professor Noelle McCaffey after she was released from custody on Thursday. She described what happened.
I was on campus this morning early for a long day meeting, and I heard and I saw that there was an encampment, and I heard some peaceful chanting. I thought I would just go and see how it was going, and also was concerned because in the past, Emory University has not just called out their own police to monitor things, but the Atlanta police. And a moment after I got there, I saw the troopers coming up. I'm not sure if they were the Georgia troopers or the Atlanta police, but they were coming up. The students were protesting with tents and all. And I was just wanting to watch, and I wandered over, and I saw suddenly things took a turn. From the students got up to start marching, and then I couldn't see exactly from where I was. They were just being attacked by the police. Over a few seconds, the police were attacking. I could hear rubber bullets. Then I smelled it or tasted the tear gas. And then I saw in front of me a student on the ground with three or four policemen pummeling the student, just pummeling and pummeling. And I tried to video it. I was standing there about 3 feet away from it. And it went on for like a minute or two. And I screamed, "What are you doing?" And then they stopped pummeling the student, and a policeman stood in front of me and said, "You need to leave." And I felt like the person who just needed to stay and witness what had just happened. And so I stood there several feet away, and then he started dragging me off and putting my hands behind my back and took me in. He took me around the side, and there were a lot of students being arrested and processed, and also some other faculty members, and we were put in a van. The president sent out an email to the community shortly thereafter saying that these were outside agitators. But I was in a group of about 20, 25 Emory people who were being arrested. So this was a peaceful protest that became chaotic. At the moment the Atlanta police arrived and became very hostile.
Arrested Professor Noel McAfee, the chair of the philosophy department at Emory University. Several Georgia legislators have criticized the police response at Emory yesterday. In a statement signed by at least 19 state Democratic lawmakers, they said they were, quote, deeply alarmed by reports of excessive force, writing, quote, the use of extreme anti-riot tactics by Georgia State Patrol, including tasers and gas, is a dangerous escalation to protests which were by all accounts peaceful and nonviolent, they wrote. For more on the protests at Emory University, we go to Atlanta, where we're joined by two guests. Emil Kameh is professor of English and Indigenous Studies at Emory University. He was also arrested at the campus yesterday, jailed for 4 hours, charged with disorderly conduct. And we're joined by Umaima Mohammed, an MD, PhD student, Palestinian American organizer at Emory, who took part in the protests. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Emil Kameh, you were arrested. Why were you out at the protest as people started to begin the encampment? And explain what happened to you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Yeah, I was just going to work. I was going to my office to prepare my classes. I was supposed to teach yesterday. And then I ran into some of my students who were participating in the protest, and I went up to say hi to them. And I also saw some of my colleagues. So I was talking to them, and then somebody had mentioned that that the university had called the police. And pretty soon they got there, and I literally felt that I was in a war zone when I saw the police with all the gear, and then they immediately began to forcibly remove and destroy all the tents and forcibly remove students. I saw then that I started feeling the tear gas, and I held arms with some people that we were being pushed back out of the encampment, and the student that I was holding arms with, she was then arrested, and then the next thing I know, I was on the floor, being forcibly on the floor, and I was being arrested. but yeah, it was like a horrible experience, very surreal, unacceptable, really unacceptable, and it was just a horrible situation, a horrible experience.
Professor, the police are denying they used rubber bullets. What did you see?
So I did see somebody being tased, and then I saw the tear gas, and I felt it in my eyes. I was also next to an older lady, and I was trying to reach her and try to see if I could offer some water. But then, you know, it's... I did see the footage, some of the videos of police using rubber bullets as well, but it was very forceful in the screams, and It was very violent and really unacceptable.
The Emory administration has also had a similar response against Stop Cop City protests on campus. Can you talk about the connections between the two?
Yeah, I mean, the protesters were not only asking the university to divest from investing in Israel, but also Cop City. And, I mean, it is the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do because it's, you know, we have to remember that universities on indigenous lands, and these are indigenous territories, and there was an eviction notice written by Muskogee leaders about not building Cap City in Atlanta, and it is a just demand, and hopefully the university will listen to what the students are saying about this, because I think it's extremely important.
I wanted to bring Umema Mohammed into this conversation. Umema, you're a MD, PhD student at Emory. Can you talk about these protests that you helped to organize and why you felt it was so key to take the stand on campus?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are at past the 7-month mark of this genocide. And on our campus and in our community, we have repeatedly organized peacefully to put pressure on our institutions, especially at Emory, to stop harassing and doxing students and to stop repressing speech around Palestine and to divest from the Israeli apartheid state. And every single time, Emory shuts us down. Every single time they crack down and they punish students. Every single time they silence our voices. And at some point, we decided that we no longer accept our tuition dollars and our tax money going to fund an act of genocide. And that was, the main motivation for a group of students and community members and faculty and graduate students coming together so powerfully in this moment to say, we just reject this. We refuse to move until Emory listens to divesting from both the apartheid state of Israel and Stop Cop City.
I read an open letter that you had written. I mean, you're particularly deeply concerned about healthcare. You quoted the Palestinian doctor, Hamam Alo, killed in November when an Israeli artillery shell struck his wife's home. His father, brother-in-law, and father-in-law also died. Democracy Now! Spoke to Dr. Alo on October 31st. This was his response when I asked him why he refused to leave his patients.
And if I go, who treats my patients? They are not animals. They have the right to receive proper health care.
Doctor,
I can just leave. You think I went to medical school and for my postgraduate degrees for a total of 14 years, so I think only about my life and not my patients?
Dr. Hamam Alo would be killed several weeks later. Umema Mohammed, can you talk about this issue of what we're seeing at this point, over 34,000 Palestinians killed, the number of doctors and nurses, staff, universities, and why this is of particular concern to you?
Yeah, so as a future healthcare professional and a current medical student, I am deeply concerned about the lack of concern healthcare institutions in America have for what we're seeing. And it's not just in Palestine. Healthcare professionals largely aren't invested in the health and care of community members, like the police violence we saw at Emory's campus. I mean, it's absolutely mind-boggling to me that these people call themselves providers and care workers and are deeply disinvested from the structural and state violence of community members, both locally and internationally. And I use that quote in a letter that I wrote to the School of Medicine a few months ago because of the absolute silence from a healthcare institution on the decimation of the healthcare system in Gaza, on their own peers being murdered in cold blood by the IDF. And so I think one of the concerns that I have with Emory and with the School of Medicine specifically is that they have also, along with the greater Emory community, participated in suppressing Palestinian voices. So a great example of this is very early on to this genocide in October, Emory fired a Palestinian physician for posting a private social media post on her Facebook in support of the Palestinians. And yet, one of the professors of medicine we have at Emory recently went to serve as a volunteer medic in the Israeli offense force and recently came back. This man participated in aiding and abetting a genocide and aiding and abetting the destruction of the healthcare system in Gaza and the murder of over 400 healthcare workers, and is now back at Emory, so-called teaching medical students and residents how to take care of patients. I mean, the disconnect is, for me, very obvious, and it's very frustrating that the School of Medicine and the greater Emory community continues to ignore these major disconnects.
I'm wondering, as we wrap up, Umama Mohammed, you're a medical student, about GILI, the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange, and this connection between Cop City, which would be the largest police training facility in the country that is being protested as it's being built in Atlanta, and the Atlanta police and Israel, what this is all about.
Absolutely. So GILI, like you said, is the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange Program, and it was started in the 90s at a university, at Georgia State University. And the function of this program is to exchange local police with international police forces. But what this program has become majorly is a connection between the Atlanta Police Force and the Israeli Offense Force. So they send Atlanta police along with people like medics and first responders over to train under a military that is illegally occupying land in Palestine to better learn surveillance techniques, to better learn tactics on how to suppress and repress protesters in Atlanta. And they bring back these techniques that are highly militarized and violent and use them against students. And in fact, yesterday we had a Palestinian student speak who said the last time that she experienced what was a war zone on Emory's campus was when she was in occupied Palestine. When we were tear gassed, all she could see was the vision of when she was in occupied Palestine, similarly being tear gassed with those tear gas canisters saying made in the USA. And so what we're seeing happening is an exchange between the Atlanta police and the Israeli Offense Force, which is currently committing a genocide, to exchange tactics on how to better surveil, repress, and harm community members.
And finally, just 10 seconds, but as you talk about the Israeli Offense Force, you're referring to what's officially known as the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. Can you explain why you call them the IOF?
Right. So we reject the idea that the Israeli Offense Force is defending anything legitimate. The Israeli Offense Force has always been on the offensive, effectively enacting ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians, effectively stealing land, creating illegal settlements, checkpoints, creating conditions that are highly unlivable for Palestinians. And that's why we use the language Israeli Offense Force, not the IDF.
Umama Mohammed, we want to thank you so much for being with us, a Palestinian-American student from Indiana, now an MD, PhD student at Emory University. And we want to thank Emil Kemeh, professor of English and Indigenous Studies at Emory University, who was arrested and charged with disorderly conduct yesterday. Meanwhile, University of Southern California has canceled their main stage graduation ceremony because of the protests. Next up, the Supreme Court hears oral arguments on Idaho's abortion ban and emergency health care. We'll talk about that, and then we'll speak with the author Ari Berman about his new book, Minority Rule, and how that has determined the current Supreme Court of the United States. Stay with us.
When a fire starts to burn, right, and it starts to spread, she gonna bring that attitude home. You don't want to do nothing with their life. When a fire starts to burn, right, and it starts to spread, she gonna bring that attitude home. You don't want to do nothing with their life. when a fire starts to burn, right, and it starts to spread, she gonna bring that attitude home. You don't wanna do nothing with their life. When a fire starts to burn, right, and it starts to spread, she gonna bring that attitude home. You don't wanna do nothing with their life. When a fire starts to when a fire starts to when a fire starts to burn, right, and it starts to spread, she gonna bring that attitude home. You don't wanna do nothing with your life. When a fire starts to burn,
when a fire starts to burn, by Disclosure. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the first Supreme Court case to examine a state ban on abortion since the justices overturned Roe v. Wade. In oral arguments Wednesday, Idaho said its abortion ban takes precedence over the federal right to receive emergency care, including an abortion. The Biden administration argued Idaho's law violates the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act by only providing emergency abortion care when a patient is facing death. This is U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar addressing the high court.
Women in Idaho today are not getting treatment. They are getting airlifted out of the state to Salt Lake City and to neighboring states where there are health exceptions in their laws because the doctors are facing mandatory minimum, 2 years in prison, loss of their license, criminal prosecution. The doctors can't provide the care because until they can conclude that a prosecutor looking over their shoulder won't second guess that maybe it wasn't really necessary to prevent death.
A ruling in this case will have major implications, and many fear will worsen racial disparities for health care in at least half a dozen other states with similar bans. According to the Centers for Disease Control, more than 80% of pregnancy-related deaths in the U.S. are preventable, and Black women are three times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women. For more, we're joined by Karen Thompson, Legal Director of Pregnancy Justice, which defends the civil and human rights of pregnant people. Her group, along with the New York University Reproductive Justice Clinic, filed a brief in the Supreme Court case. She also has written a piece in The Nation, headline, "This Supreme Court case could worsen maternal health nationwide." Welcome to Democracy Now!, Karen. It's great to have you with us. Why don't you lay out what this Idaho ban is all about and specifically what it means when a patient goes into an emergency room and the kind of care that they get?
Yes. So EMTALA was created.
And EMTALA is...
The Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act was passed in 1986 to prevent patient dumping. So the entire point of it was to ensure that everyone had stabilizing medical care when they presented at an ER. Post-Dobbs, we have Idaho with its almost complete abortion ban, saying that abortion care is basically criminalized. So we have this inherent conflict between what EMTALA is trying to provide and what Idaho is trying to actually criminalize and ban. And what that means is that people who need the care, people who present because their pregnancies are actually killing them, are in Idaho not able to get the care that they need.
So if you can talk about what it means if a person goes into the emergency room and the doctors, what they have to assess, if they're septic, for example, that could lead to them being infertile. When do they decide if she is near death?
That's unclear, and that's part of the problem. That was one of the questions that was asked on Wednesday.
Let's go to that question right now. U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar, being questioned by Justice Elena Kagan.
So in that situation, what Idaho is doing is waiting for women to wait and deteriorate and suffer the lifelong health consequences with no possible upside for the fetus. It just stacks tragedy upon tragedy.
And it can't be the appropriate, you know, it's become transfer is the appropriate standard of care in Idaho, but it can't be the right standard of care to force somebody onto a helicopter.
Justice Samuel Alito used the language of fetal personhood in writing the court's majority opinion when they overturned Dobbs, when they overturned Roe v. Wade in the Dobbs decision. This is Justice Alito speaking Wednesday.
And we've now heard, an hour and a half of argument on this case. And one potentially very important phrase in EMTALA has hardly been mentioned maybe it hasn't even been mentioned at all, and that is EMTALA's reference to the woman's quote-unquote unborn child. Isn't that an odd phrase to put in a statute that imposes a mandate to perform abortions? Have you ever seen an abortion statute that uses the phrase unborn child?
It's not an odd phrase.
That was Samuel Alito. Explain exactly the implications of what he's saying and what Justice Kagan was asking about.
Alito is trying to assert this idea that the fetus replaces the pregnant person, that there's somehow more rights or equal rights for that fetus than the person who is actually dying. Right. So, and I don't mean to be hyperbolic. People think that there's a lot of hysteria going on. But the fact is, people are going to die. They are going to be bleeding out in hospital rooms. They're going to be dying from sepsis because doctors are not going to be able to make the choices that they need to make to give people the care that will save their lives in these emergency situations.
So how do doctors make these decisions?
It's tricky. They have to decide that someone is close enough to death. And that's why we heard Kagan say that people are being airlifted, because doctors are scared to make those decisions. If they make the wrong decisions, what happens is that they can either get criminally charged and face 2 to 5 years in prison. They can have the family of the pregnant person sue them for $20,000 for performing the abortion, or they can lose their license. So even if they are coming in with their best medical decisions, they're still facing this prosecution, which is not exactly going to keep them making decisions that are going to be in favor of that pregnant person.
Were you surprised by the line of questioning at all?
Completely. I was horrified. And I think what's really interesting to hear is the voices of Justice Jackson, Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, and even Justice Barrett. They were horrified by the line of questioning and the idea that someone's health doesn't matter, because the Idaho ban doesn't allow any exceptions for abortion for the health of the mother, only for her life. And so I think they were just absolutely gobsmacked at the idea that someone losing their fertility, someone suffering the pain of what's actually going on with them, would be ignored again for this fetus.
So Karen Thompson, let's talk about Idaho and the other states. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about a number of states who have these near total bans on abortion and how mm-hmm. they affect maternal mortality, mm-hmm. The rates going up in those states. And of course, when it comes to maternal mortality, black maternal mortality is always higher.
Always. And that's a legacy, sadly, and a remnant of slavery. We know that black women are not trusted. They're not given the same care. And what that leads to is poorer fetal and maternal health care outcomes. If EMTALA is not allowed to stand, if those same women, if those same communities are showing at ERs for care for their pregnancies, for issues in their pregnancies, which they're already experiencing at a higher level, then we're going to see this kind of slippery slope of a lack of care for the people who need it the most. And it's not a coincidence that these total ban states are really overlapping with the states of the Confederacy.
So how are you organizing, and what is pregnancy justice doing?
Well, we are fighting this idea of fetal personhood, because fetal personhood is the cause. It is the center of so many other things. We saw that with the IVF decision in Alabama. We saw that with the mifepristone arguments last week in the Supreme Court.
The abortion pill.
So we are trying to fight this idea that a fetus has the same rights as you and I, because from that space grows all sorts of pregnancy criminalization.
Now, in Idaho, when the ban went into effect, hospitals had to medically evacuate several women to receive emergency abortion care, evacuate them to other states?
Absolutely, because the doctors, again, are afraid to provide the care that these people need, right? But if you don't have a doctor near you, if you don't have the care at the hospital in your community, you have to go somewhere to get it, and that care might include abortions. And if Idaho's not going to provide it, you have to go to Washington, you have to go to neighboring states to make sure that it is provided. And so that's what we're seeing that happen, 6 medevaced cases in the last 4 months.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Karen Thompson, Legal Director of Pregnancy Justice, national nonprofit that defends the civil and human rights of pregnant people. Her group, along with the NYU Reproductive Justice Clinic, filed a brief in the Supreme Court case. Her new piece for The Nation will link to at democracynow.org. This Supreme Court case could worsen maternal health nationwide. Coming up, journalist and author Ari Berman argues the current Supreme Court is the product of minority rule. That's right. Five of the six conservative justices were chosen by two presidents. Both lost the popular vote in the United States, George W. Bush and President Trump. His new book is called Minority Rule, the Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. Stay with us.
All the rain gathers in the sky. How could our world run dry? You said it's time for goodbye. You said our time does fly. Oh, but we're still riding high. How could our world run dry?
Peter Rue. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Supreme Court hears oral arguments in cases ranging from a ban on emergency abortions in Idaho to whether former President Donald Trump is immune from prosecution, our next guest argues the Supreme Court is the product of minority rule. In his new book, journalist and author Ari Berman outlines how, for the first time in U.S. history, five of six conservative justices on the Supreme Court were appointed by Republican presidents who lost the popular vote and confirmed by senators elected by a minority of Americans. Ari Berman says the court's makeup is the product of two skewed institutions, how we elect our presidents through the Electoral College and how we appoint U.S. senators, both of which are flawed because they both violate one person, one vote. Ari Berman joins us now in our New York studio. His new book is called Minority Rule, the Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. He's the voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones magazine, also author of Give Us the Ballot, the Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Ari.
So great to see you, Amy.
Congratulations on the release of the book.
Thank you.
Why don't we start off with what happened this week, the oral arguments on whether Trump has immunity as president of the United States.
Well, it was a new low even for this Supreme Court, because it showed the extent that they're willing to enable Donald Trump's authoritarianism and rig the political process for Republicans. First off, you have to step back and realize how they took this case, right? They waited so long to take the case that they made it basically impossible for there to be a trial on Trump inciting the insurrection before the election. So that in and of itself was a huge victory for Donald Trump. And then when you got to the oral arguments themselves, I mean, it was stunning, some of the stuff they were saying. They basically ignored the entire history of the insurrection. And they seemed more concerned about a president being prosecuted for something than a president inciting the insurrection. So Samuel Alito says this could be destabilizing to democracy if a president is prosecuted. What was destabilizing to democracy, Amy, was the effort to overturn the election and the insurrection at the Capitol. So it showed that the Supreme Court is a deeply, deeply undemocratic institution. And they will go to nearly any lengths to ensure that Republicans can win elections, that Donald Trump's authoritarianism will be allowed to go forward.
And talk more about presidential immunity, what it means.
What it means is that a president can do anything, basically, in office and can't be held accountable for it. I mean, they said very clearly the president could order the assassination of someone, and unless he is impeached by the Senate, he can get away with it. So remember when Trump said, I could kill someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it? Basically, that's what they were arguing before the Supreme Court. I mean, it was so incredible just how the Supreme Court was downplaying the most authoritarian act in modern American history and basically saying there should be no legal consequences for this, and that not only will there be no legal consequences, but voters won't even get to hear the evidence against Donald Trump that has been amassed by Special Prosecutor Jack Smith before the election. We're facing a situation where unless the voters themselves decide not to elect Donald Trump, there will be no accountability through the legal process for inciting an insurrection at the Capitol. That is just absolutely stunning.
I'm wondering if you then can talk about the current Supreme Court, how it's made up, and how it illustrates your major thesis in your new book, Minority Rule.
So the major thesis of my new book is that a shrinking conservative white minority has rigged the political process in favor of an extreme faction of the Republican Party, basically to prevent a much more broader and more diverse majority from taking power. And the Supreme Court is a perfect illustration of that because it is the product of two anti-democratic institutions. It's a product of presidents, Republican presidents, who lost the popular vote, and it's a product of conservative senators who don't represent a minority of Americans appointing the conservative justices. So we have a the way we elect presidents violates one person, one vote. The way we elect senators violates one person, one vote. That has led to a rigged Supreme Court. Then the rigged Supreme Court themselves has further rigged the political process to benefit Republicans through things like gutting the Voting Rights Act, allowing dark money through Citizens United, and also issuing decisions that are at odds with the majority of Americans, overturning Roe v. Wade, overturning gun control, overturning environmental protection. So a product of Minority Rule has then deepened minority rule in the U.S. And basically, Republicans have used the courts, and particularly the Supreme Court, to do all these unpopular things because they know they can't win on them otherwise.
Talk about the history, for example, the Constitutional Convention, why it is that states that are increasingly depopulated are represented by two senators in the same way that states that have millions more people still have the same two senators.
What I wanted to do in the book was trace the crisis of democracy we face right now all the way back to the founding period and basically say that the founding fathers created democratic institutions that weren't actually that democratic. And that laid the groundwork for the current crisis we have today, because by giving each senators the same number of representation, so each state gets two senators no matter the representation, what that means then is that you have a situation where whiter, smaller, more rural states get far more representation than more diverse, more urban, more progressive states. And this has gotten dramatically worse over time, Amy. So in 1790, after the Constitution was ratified, the country's largest state, Virginia, had 12 times the population of the country's smallest state, Delaware. Now, California, the largest state, has 67 times the population of the smallest state, Wyoming. That basically means that the Senate ensures minority rule by allowing essentially a minority of conservative Americans to elect a majority of the Senate when Republicans are in control.
You quote John Adams in Minority Rule saying, if a majority were to control all branches of the government, debts would be abolished first, taxes laid heavy on the rich and not at all on the others, and at last, downright equal vision of everything would be demanded and voted.
It just goes to show you that the founders were not chiefly interested in equality or even really democracy. They were concerned with protecting the power of people like themselves, which was wealthy white landowners. And they created
male
all of,
landowners.
Exactly, wealthy white male landowners. And so a majority of Americans were excluded from the country's most important democratic document. Women, African Americans, Native Americans, even poor white people were excluded from these democratic institutions. And so it's a fundamental contradiction that the country's most important democratic document, the Constitution, was actually intended in many ways to make the country less democratic.
Talk about countries like Delaware and the Constitutional Convention and what they threatened tiny countries versus Virginia, much larger states.
Yeah, exactly. This was fascinating to me when I went back and researched the history, because we have all these things that are called compromises, right? The idea that each state should have the same number of senators is called the Great Compromise. But it's actually the Great Concession, because a lot of the architects of the Constitution, people like James Madison, hated the idea that this, each state would have the same number of senators. They wanted the Senate to be based on proportional representation. They wanted it to be an elite body, but they wanted it to represent the greatest number of Americans. And basically, the smaller states said, if you don't give us the same level of representation, we will leave the Union and find a foreign ally. We may rejoin England or join France. So they basically held a gun to the head of the delegates and said, give us this power or we won't ratify the Constitution. The same thing happened with the slave states, Amy, through the Three-Fifths Clause, so that the southern states would have far more power in the House of Representatives and in the Electoral College. So what we see through the Constitution is that these smaller minority groups, not minority groups as we think of them in terms of voters of color, but small states, slave states, they basically had a huge advantage in the Constitution. And those undemocratic features, even as we've democratized since, have become pronounced in a way that they're threatening representative government today.
Let me turn to Paul Weyrich, who's described as the founding father of the conservative movement, speaking at a religious rights gathering in Dallas in 1980, 40 years ago.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Significance of what Paul Weyrich is saying.
I mean, an incredible quote that just says the quiet part out loud and really lays out the strategy of the conservative movement, which is when fewer people participate in democracy, it benefits this shrinking conservative white minority. And what I argue in the book is that there's this historical anti-democratic institutions, but then there's all these new anti-democratic tactics that are layered onto it. So things like voter suppression, election subversion, gerrymandering, the censoring of history, all of which is being used to maintain white power as the country is shifting demographically. And that's what makes these anti-democratic tactics so dangerous.
Talk about the Electoral College.
Well, just such a fundamentally undemocratic institution. I tried to explain the Electoral College recently to my 9-year-old daughter, and she looked at me like I was crazy. The idea that someone could get more votes but lose the election is just crazy for her, right? Or to anybody when you explain it. And the Electoral College is also a fundamentally undemocratic institution. The founders did not trust the public to directly elect the president, so they created this incredibly undemocratic mechanism that would give elite white men the power to choose the president. And it was fundamentally flawed from the start because the Electoral College was a basis of how we elect our representatives, meaning that small states had more power because of the U.S. Senate and slave states had more power because of the Three-Fifths Clause. So the combined weight of the slave states and of the small states meant that for the beginning of our country, Amy, 10 of 12 U.S. presidents were slaveholders. 18 of the first 31 Supreme Court justices were slaveholders, and a majority of House speakers before the Civil War were slaveholders. So it's amazing. Basically, racism is baked in to the Constitution. I want people to understand that, because we venerate the Constitution as if it's this godlike document. And we have to have a more realistic discussion over the founding of our country, that racism is built into our institutions. It remains a problem today. And our institutions are so antiquated, so undemocratic, that we need fundamental reform to change them, to democratize them.
Where does three-fifths fit into all of this?
Well, what three-fifths meant is that African Americans were defined as three-fifths of a person. What that meant is that even though they were enslaved and disenfranchised in the South, the southern states got more representation because of their enslaved population, which is incredible. And that was another thing when they tried to get rid of that. The slave states basically said, we won't ratify the Constitution unless you give us this power. What it meant is that the southern states had a third more representation in the House of Representatives because of the Three-Fifths Clause than they would have had otherwise. That then warped the presidency, because what it meant is that the House of Representatives had the power with the Senate to determine the number of electoral votes. So as I said, what it means is that slave states had a disproportionate amount of power both in the House of Representatives and in the Electoral College until the Civil War.
It makes me think about prisoners in many of the states in this country. For example, in New York, so many people of color taken from downstate, upstate, and upstate, they count as the population, increasing the population, so they have more representation, but they can't vote.
Yeah, exactly. And that prison gerrymandering and that kind of thing is just one example of the anti-democratic features that remain today. And so what I want people to understand is that we need to reform these undemocratic institutions. We can't just fight for the rights and freedoms we have today. We need broader reform to fully democratize this country in a way that we've never done.
And that is the final part of your title, and the fight to resist it. Can you talk about the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact? I mean, Maine just joined. There's 207 now, representing 207 votes going to 270, and the whole thing changes.
Exactly.
Explain what that is.
The idea is that if states that would add up to 270 electoral college votes, which is what you need to win the presidency, would pledge to appoint their electors to the popular vote, that would then abolish the electoral college. Now, I'm sure the conservative Supreme Court would want to weigh in on this, but it's a mechanism to do an end round around amending the Constitution, because the Constitution is so difficult to amend. And what I talk about in the book is, as you say, the fight back and this long push and pull between democratic and anti-democratic forces throughout American history. And we're at another major tipping point today where there's forces that are trying to constrict American democracy and there's forces that are trying to expand American democracy. And that's really the choice facing the country right now, is which way are we going to go?
Where does Trump and Project 2025 fit into this?
Well, Project 2025 is basically the project for Trump's second term. And what it does is it's trying to enshrine Trump's authoritarianism and make it part of the entire fabric of the federal government. And that's why I want people to understand Trump has a plan for 2024 that is far more radical and far more dangerous than what he entered in to 2016, because the entire conservative movement has now endorsed Donald Trump's authoritarianism. So we should listen to what he has to say. He has a plan to make minority rule impossible to reverse. People take democracy for granted. And I want them to understand, if Donald Trump gets back in office and implements his authoritarian agenda, it could be very difficult, if not impossible, to reverse that.
Trump has made unfounded claims that Democrats are helping undocumented immigrants sign up to illegally vote in the presidential election. This is Trump speaking earlier this year.
I believe now that that's why they're allowing these people to come in. People that don't speak our language, they're signing them up to vote. And I believe that's why you're having millions of people pour into our country. And it could very well affect the next election. And I believe that's why they're doing it.
Your response, Ari Berman?
Well, it's a total lie. I mean, it's another total falsehood by the president. First off, migrants are not crossing the border illegally to vote for Democrats. Secondly, it's illegal for them to do so. And there's built-in checks and balances in our voting system to prevent people from voting illegally. But what he's trying to do is he is trying to use these scare tactics to preserve white power. And he's demonizing immigration to try to make the country more white. And he's also trying to make it harder to vote by demonizing immigrants to benefit Republicans. And what I argue is so much of the Republican push for minority rule today is about the fear of a majority-minority future in which white people will no longer be the majority of the country by 2045. And I think that's motivating Trump and the conservative movement to basically build a fortress to stop what they view as the coming siege.
What most shocked you in your years of research for this book, Minority Rule?
Just the extent to which the crisis of democracy is so much bigger than Donald Trump. I think a lot of people think that Trump is an unprecedented threat, and in many ways he is. He is an accelerant to an undemocratic political system, but he's also a product of an undemocratic political system. And that's why I talk about the undemocratic aspects of the Constitution. That's why I talk about the violent backlash to multiracial democracy during Reconstruction, because there are precedents for Donald Trump. He didn't just come out of nowhere. He is an authoritarian leader that benefits from a deeply undemocratic political system. And that's why we need to change the political system itself if we want to prevent more Trumps in the future.
What are the most promising resistance movements to this that you see?
I think the most promising resistance movements right now are at the state level in places like Michigan, where people are using direct democracy to expand rights and to fight a rigged political system, where they're doing things like ending partisan gerrymandering, expanding voting rights, enshrining abortion access. It's very easy to get dismayed at what's happening at the federal level and feel like it's impossible to change it. But you look at Michigan, you look at Wisconsin, a lot of really interesting things are happening at the state level where the push for minority rule has led to an equally fierce push for majority rule. And the forces that are trying to rig American democracy have led to a broader pro-democracy movement to protect it.
Ari Berman, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I know you'll be at the Brooklyn Public Library speaking with Chris Hayes on Monday night and going around the country with your book. Journalist and author Ari Berman, his new book, Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. Voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.